Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Sharing with you a conversation with a Japanese bishop. Respecting my weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover who takes us on a papal picnic. And marking the 40th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. But first, the latest from the Vatican, or rather from Benedict XVI's summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, where the Pope on Friday, 25th of July, met with the Iraqi Prime Minister. Charles Collins tells us more.
Pope Benedict on Friday met with the Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki. The Prime Minister also met with the Holy See's Secretary of State, Cardinal Tartizio Bertone, and the Secretary for Relations with States, Dominique Mamberti. In a communique issued by the Holy See Press Office, it was revealed that the talks examined the situation in Iraq as well as the entire region. Special attention was paid to the plight of Iraqi refugees, both outside and inside the country, the assistance they needed, as well as their wish to return to their homes. The parties also renewed their condemnation of the continuing violence in the country, which daily hits different parts of Iraq and also affects the Christian community, which is in great need of security. They also expressed their hope that Iraq can find the way of peace and development through the dialogue and collaboration of all ethnic and religious groups, including minorities. To that end, the importance of interreligious dialogue was reiterated. Prime Minister Maliki also extended an invitation for the Holy Father to visit Iraq. I'm Charles Collins.
I'd now like to mark a special anniversary with Time magazine correspondent at the time of the Second Vatican Council, who recalls some of the meticulous preparatory work leading up to the encyclical Humanae Vitae, or of human life, on artificial contraception. They say that Paul VI, the baffling but brilliant Pope who died exactly 30 years ago on the 6th of August 1978, had to steer the Catholic Church through a council he would never have called. Likewise, according to Robert Blair Kaiser, correspondent for Time magazine during those heady council days, he also found himself having to steer and implement a commission on birth control, set up by his predecessor to the See of Peter.
It was John XXIII who started the Papal Birth Control Commission. He had six members who met once for a period of a few days before he died.
A commission set up by Pope John, according to Kaiser, to diffuse controversy surrounding this delicate issue. He feared it would create too much of a diversion, so decided to take it off the table by appointing a birth control commission outside the council, yet at the same time in the context of the council. A commission implemented by Paul VI, then.
And when Paul VI came in, he amplified it to 72 members, and he brought in six married couples, as well as all these experts, not only in theology, but in demography, sociology, and psychology, and psychiatry. They were all very loyal Catholics. But over the course of their meeting for 4 years, they moved from the right to the left. And they ended up by advising the Pope that he had to change the Church's teaching on birth control.
But Paul VI had the last word with his encyclical, Humanae Vitae, or of Human Life.
Testimonianza morale nella società come.
And as it turns 40, the encyclical's teachings stay put. In May, Pope Benedict XVI called it a gesture of courage. And while acknowledging that its teachings have been controversial and difficult for Catholics, he insisted the text expressed the true design of human procreation.
Allora ciò che si deve difendere non è più solo il vero concetto dell'amore, ma in primo luogo la dignità della persona stessa.
Big thank you there to Time magazine correspondent at the time of the Second Vatican Council, Robert Blair Kaiser. And now turning the page, moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to leave the Vatican and take you to the Far East, focusing a little in depth on a part of the world I've rarely spoken about on this weekly program, Japan. It's an opportunity I've been looking forward to for some time now, Ever since I met one of the 17 bishops from the 16 dioceses of Japan who came to Rome on their ad limina visit earlier this year.
Japan is a faraway country, so it is not well understood. So we are feeling that Rome is far away, yes. We have the difficulty to communicate.
Divine Word missionary Bishop Isao Kikuchi of the Diocese of Niigata is from Honshu in the north of Japan, an island as large as Taiwan, on the coast of the Sea of Japan, facing Russia. A place his diocese where 4 million people live, only 7,000 of whom are Catholics. It's a rice-growing area where the bishop is keen to add they make the best sake. I sat down with him when he came to Rome recently, and we had a long chat in an effort to find out more about the reality of being Catholics in this faraway nation. What are the big challenges that you have as a church in Japan?
I think at this moment is the secularization, especially among the young people, the society in general. People are not finding the meaning of any religion or any God. Also, the number of the elder people are growing, and we don't have the young people to support the society. And this is directly affecting the Catholic Church, too. If you visit the parishes in Japan on Sunday services, Sunday masses, and you find many old people, but not the young people. That also creates the financial problem, too. And thirdly, about the how to take care of the migrant Catholics. These are the main issues at this moment.
In a few moments, I'll be sharing with you more of our conversation. But not without beginning, perhaps, by stepping back in time and shining the spotlight on the clan chieftains, the daimyos, with their armed retainers, the samurai, bound to them in loyalty by the strictest code of honour. Well, stay tuned and watch the change of pace. Japan, the land of the rising sun. The date is 1542. A Portuguese ship sails into its shores, bringing guns to threaten the samurai's skill at arms, but also bringing the Christian faith. A faith which preached a devotion to a higher power than that in place, that of the emperor, worshipped almost as God by his people, but also that of the shoguns, the heads of the clans who held the political power. A devotion so unwelcome that less than half a century later, 26 Christians are martyred by crucifixion in Nagasaki. And from then on, a reality for Christians that could be summed up in the word persecution. Right until World War II. I thought I'd like to find out more about why Christianity was so unaccepted in Japan. Was it simply just considered a threat to the political power across Japan at the time?
Until the 16th century, there are so many daimyo, those who have the local power. They try to reorganize Japan under the auspice of the emperor, and then Christianity is organizing the people in the structure of the Catholic Church, and that was actually threatening to those who were in power at that time. So they thought that some foreign power is coming into Japan, try to organize something against the structure of the Japanese society at that time.
I ventured to ask if there might be another reason, like, for example, the reflection of a Western culture, totally foreign to an Eastern culture like the Japanese.
That's right, it's completely different, the idea, because like believing in one God, is completely different from the Japanese traditional belief. Usually the Japanese believe that something like animism, there are so many spirits all over, but then now the Christianity comes in and saying that there is only one God created the world and that there is only one Savior, Jesus Christ. That is completely foreign to the Japanese understanding.
Bishop Kikuchi is a second-generation Catholic. But in a land where those who belong to our faith are far and few, this must have created a few problems for him when he grew up. In fact, as I discovered, in his school he was the only one among his 40 or so fellow classmates.
Every Sunday, when these other kids, my friends, are going for baseball or soccer or something, but I have to go to church and for the Sunday Mass. And people thought, people considered me as a bit different, yes.
Now, I knew how non-Catholic parents right across Asia succumb to the lure of the high standards of Catholic education, and wondered if this was the case in Japan as well.
I think the past maybe 100 years, that is correct, especially after the missionaries came in again in the end of 19th century. The missionaries tried to establish the schools all over Japan, especially in the big cities. And most of the schools acquire the good name. And that's why many people graduated, especially those who are renowned people, the famous people like writers, journalists, politicians. Many of them graduated from the Catholic schools, and that is actually affecting somehow to create a good image of the Catholic Church in Japan.
I also knew how immigrant communities were helping plump the ranks of Catholics in Japan. I'd done my homework and knew some were from Latin America, but that they were only there for the most part to work, make money, and then return home. Unlike those other immigrants, the Filipinos. But I'll let Bishop Kikuchi tell you about them, because their presence in his diocese is good news, simply because it follows a pattern of integration.
My diocese, majority of the migrants are the Filipinas, married with the Japanese farmers. They are going to reside in Japan, so they are going to try to adapt themselves to the Japanese culture.
But I thought, what about Japanese society? What happens there? Is it a highly secularized one where people show little interest for anything transcendent, much like in our Western world?
Yeah, I think so, because especially after the Second World War, maybe that time the Japan was so poor and people really interested into the religion. And 1950s and 1960s, many people were baptized because after the war, the people are looking for the peace and they are looking for the meaning of the life. And so many people coming to the church, and then we had quite a number of the baptism. But then after that, Japanese society went through all this development, and then of course the entire society was trying to be like Western countries. And this is the result, what we have at this moment. We just became like a Western countries, yes.
More broadly, I asked Bishop Kikuchi if there were a lack of interest also in traditional religion for Japan, like Buddhism, for example.
Yes, that's right. Our area is supposed to be the stronghold for the Buddhism, because some of the famous Buddhist monks in Japan are born in my area, and there are so many Buddhist temples, but the Buddhist temple is now becoming like a place for the funerals. Not there. You see, they come, they remember us, they remember that somebody dies in the family, and then they are the members of this Buddhist temple. But the usual, daily life, they have nothing to do with the religion.
Bishop Kikuchi was full of surprises for me. He linked this question of mine to the lack of interest in religion to a disturbing social scourge in Japanese society, suicide.
So many people commit suicide, and that is one of the problems, I think, and not only in my diocese, but all over Japan, but particularly in Akita Prefecture.
Why do you think that is, that there's so much suicide? Is it among young people, too?
Well, the young people and also the old people too. Especially in Akita, it's famous for the old farmers, those who have nothing to do anymore. And then young people are migrating out to the big cities and nobody to take care of these old people in the family, and they are depressed. Because the farmers, nowadays, farmers doesn't mean that they can make money. Problem is, I think, traditionally, if somebody wants to go through this difficulty of depression, usually traditional religion has support to take care of these people, giving them the material support, not only the material support, but the spiritual support also. But this is not happening anymore. People don't know where to go, where to find the support. And maybe that's the main reason why they're just depressed and disappointed with the life and commit suicide.
You mentioned that your area is a Buddhist stronghold. What kind of relations do you have with the Buddhist community? For example, in a situation like this, where you have to find solutions for all these people who are committing suicide, etc., do you work together at all?
We don't have any problem among ourselves, but we don't have much cooperation as such. Buddhism is also divided into different sects. There are so many sects. And you see, the biggest difference between this Buddhist religion and Christianity is, Christianity, we have the congregation. We have the people to come together regularly, like every Sunday. We can easily organize the people to do something for others. But for the Buddhist, they don't have this kind of the regular worship. So they don't have some kind of what we call congregations. People belong to the Buddhist religion doesn't mean that they come regularly to the Buddhist temple. So they don't have much to do with the community itself. For example, 2004 and also this year, twice the Niigata was hit by the earthquake. It was a big earthquake and quite a number of people died, killed. And more than thousands of people lost their houses. It was the biggest donation from the religious organization to the victims was given by the Catholic Church. Like, I'm in charge of the Caritas Japan, and we made a campaign in Japan to collect the donation from the people. And we donated the biggest amount to the prefecture government as a religious organization. But the Buddhists, they couldn't do the same. Well, of course, they did try to support people, but they couldn't manage to collect so much money. And also the material support, the Catholic Church was quite quick to move.
You mentioned Caritas. What is your position exactly in Japan in terms of Caritas?
I'm president of the Caritas Japan.
What is the thrust of the work of Caritas Japan?
Well, the Caritas Japan, first and most, we organize the Lenten campaign, then we collect the money, and the main work is to send the money to the other country to help other small Caritases all over the world. But in Japan itself, we don't have much actually to do, because like when this kind of a disaster happens, the government is very quick to move, and the government has the ability to organize like an army and other section of the government to try to help the people. So we don't have much to do in Japan. But what we do is try to bring the information to the people in Japan, like what is happening in other country, what is happening in like Africa and Asian countries. There are people suffering, people waiting for the support. Then we try to communicate this information to the general public in Japan and try to raise fund. And then through this fund, we try to support the activities of other Caritases in other country.
The Japanese then, from what you're saying, or the Japanese church is a generous church. It's outward looking.
Yes, I think so. The people are really generous about supporting others, yes.
Is that its greatest strength, or what would you describe as its greatest strength?
I think we are, though we are a small church, small community, But we are still trying to support somebody, like not only among our own Japanese people, but also the outside Japan. So I think that is one of the strengths we have, yes.
Well, what are your personal hopes for your diocese?
Children from this international marriage, Filipinas married with the Japanese farmers, they are the hope for my diocese. These Filipina mothers are very faithful, and we're trying to educate these children according to our own traditional faith, and so they are the hope.
Warm thanks there to Divine Word missionary Bishop Isao Kikuchi of the Diocese of Niigata in Japan, who, as you've just heard, is also president of Caritas Japan. And now to end the broadcast, time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. And as Pope Benedict is about to go on holiday, I thought it might be timely to speak to him of papal picnics. Don't be misled as I start speaking about whales instead. We heard how a while back a whale was found swimming up the River Thames.
Oh, no.
How do you say there
disorientated, was... poor thing. Mm.
How do you say there was a disorientated whale inside the Thames?
Cete seductum ingressum est Tamisium fluvium. Tamisium, if I'm mistaken, the Thames. Tamisium fluvium. Seductum, having been led off or having been seducted, having been by nature the... or the brain or something, the poor things, and when they all go up on the shore and die.
Think that the Romans ever found any whales in the Thames?
No, but they had dolphins. They had sea monsters like sharks out here at Ostia. All the famous stories of the dolphins at Ostia. Oh, you can't believe it.
Like what?
I mean, the famous story with a boy and stuff that was drowning, and a dolphin came along and lifted him up and brought him to shore. Pliny talks about that. It's beautiful.
Can you tell me the tale in Latin?
Well, not the whole thing.
Well, you tell. Let's
said, "Mergibatur, mergibatur puerulus."
A little boy.
In mari.
In the sea.
Quod cum vidisser delphinus, which when a dolphin had seen, acucur, it ran up, suoque dorso, and with his back, sustulit puerum extra aquam, out of the water, eumque detulit in arenam in litus, to the shore. Ergo est narratio celeberima, qui in vinitro apud plinium nisi fallor, de puero et delfino.
It's a famous story about the little boy and the dolphin.
Which is found, if I'm not mistaken, in Plinius.
They had the...
Pius Sextus was also out there. Pius Secundus Piccolomini. And they went out there. He wanted to see, the ruins of Ostia. And the fishermen heard that, and they caught a huge, huge... Well, it wasn't a weird dolphin. It wasn't a dolphin. Like, I don't know, a swordfish or something. Ooh, and they had a whole feast for the Pope. So they had
a
huge...
A papal picnic.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
So how do you say that? Papal picnic with sharks.
Yeah. With sharks. Cum cete. It's indeclinable. Cum cete cena de symbolis a pontifice est per acta. Okay. A dinner from contributions. That's a picnic. A pontifice est per acta was carried out by the Pope. Oh, he loved it. And they were crazy because they caught this fish and they roasted it. And,
on the beach?
Well, no, a little at Ostia, like at the ruins today, which is about 3 miles from the beach.
There's like an estuary.
Well, I mean, it's the Tiber River going out. But in those days, I mean, his day, 1400s, it's just about the way it is today.
So how would they have had this meal? Well, I mean...
Oh, he describes the whole thing in his autobiography. They set up tents, just like a picnic, tents, and ooh. Then a storm came and blew all the tents down.
He describes it all.
Pius
II, when he was a pope?
Oh, no, he wrote this when he was a pope at the end of his life. So one of the most readable autobiographies in the world. his commentari, the commentaries of things that happened at his time. Oh, it's so fascinating, you can't put it down.
So what did he say?
They prayed and they said, well, God saved us, or I don't know what happened, or the storm went away, or we weren't killed, et cetera, et cetera. And the next day he took a boat back to down the street here.
Okay, how do you say that? We weren't killed during the storm?
No, inter effecti sumus procella et idioque postridie navem conscendimus et devenimus Romam. We came down to Rome.
What kind of a ship would they have had in time?
These are little boats. They didn't. He didn't need that. Rowboats.
Rowboats.
Yeah, I mean maybe 10 people. You know, like one of those things. Mm. But they had the mast. They had the three remes, what they call the three banks of oars. These were military ships. I mean, battleships. But that's a heaven. He didn't need that. He just got into a little thing and psst.
And he went back to the Vatican.
Yeah. Seconda Loggia, or First Loggia. This is the 1400s, you see, before the Sistine Chapel was thought of. So all those infamous, or let's say fascinating stories. Ecomnia narrantur ab eo. I gave the students one of their last sheets the other day from Pius II. Where there was a plot against him here in Rome. Ooh, some military people from the different areas were conspirabant adversus pontificem. He heard about it. He had him rounded up and put in Castel San Angelo. That wasn't too nice.
How do you say rounded up and put
rounded up a collecti sunt. Well, usi sunt collegi et proici in Archem Sancti Angeli. Would punerentur to be punished, edita poro, and so forth and so on.
Did the passageway exist? The passageway existed between St. Peter's, the Apostolic Palace.
And, not the one we have now. I think this is Pius IV, which is the next century. You have Pius IV's name on what we have today. But there was a thing there, like a bridge kind of a work.
Was Pius II, apart from writing and being a brilliant Latinist, did he do a lot of building during his pontificate?
Building? No, not so much building. He had his poor thing. He was only a pope for 50 to 64, 6 years.
Was it usual for popes to wander around Ostia in those days and have picnics?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, there's another one he describes incredibly beautiful. He went out to Castle Gandolfo. He describes the whole lake, and he was in the woods there, and, you know, the two lakes there, your two lakes, you know. And he describes everything, and the Roman ruins in those days, the 1450s.
Nemi and Albano.
Yeah, Lago di Nemi, and then on the other side. What's on the other?
Lago
Nemi
di
is
Albano.
On the other side, is yeah. Nemi.
And Lago di Albano.
Yeah, on this side, yeah. Mm. Oh, he did, that's beautifully described. All that stuff.
Nemi was Nero's haunt.
Yeah, and then they find the boats of Caligula there.
Yeah.
In the mud. Mussolini found them. And they drained the whole lake, you know, and pulled them out of the mud into a museum, right out of the mud on tracks into a museum. They were burnt in 1944 by certain people retreating to Germany.
A heartfelt thanks there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.